Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Near the end of World War II, a train left Hungary headed towards Berlin. It was filled with paintings, gold, jewels, china, carpet, valuables, and heirloom Judaica plundered from Hungary's Jewish communities. Eventually stopping in Salzburg at war's end, the train was turned over to the occupying American army, where slowly but surely, many items disappeared. This historical event is the focus for novelist Ayelet Waldman's latest book, Love and Treasure. In 1945, Jack Wiseman, a smart, secular New York Jew, is the officer charged with guarding the treasure, responsibility that grows more complicated when he falls in love with a young Hungarian survivor of the Holocaust. The book begins as Jack is dying in Maine and entrusts a bejeweled locket with an unusual peacock motif to his granddaughter, Natalie Stein. Jack asks Natalie to return the locket stolen from the gold train so many years ago to its rightful owner, if that owner can be found. Natalie's search leads to Budapest and Israel, straight into the heart of the underworld of art dealers, stolen and repatriated artwork from World War II. Ayelet Waldman is the best-selling author of the novels Red Hook Road and Love and Other Impossible Pursuits, as well as the essay collection Bad Mother. Her latest book, Love and Treasure, is published by Knopf, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Ayelet Waldman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
This book, Love and Treasure, it's sort of in the headlines because every time you turn around, there is more artwork that is being returned to the heirs of its rightful owner. This is an issue that 65, 70 years since the war, it still remains in the news, and that is the central focus of Love and Treasure, is what happened to the treasures of Jews and other people who were a part of the Holocaust after the war's end. And you focus on a particular, I guess this was historically based, train.
Absolutely, yeah.
Called the Hungarian Treasure Train, Gold Train.
There was this, the Hungarian Gold Train. You know, it's so funny because when I started working on this book, it wasn't so much in the news, and then Monuments Men came out, and then all of these recent discoveries. The Hungarian Gold Train was a story I had never heard about, but that I found in my research. It was a trainload of the plunder of the Jews of Hungary, and who had been a very, very wealthy community with great, you know, not just art collections like in Paris and in other places, but they had lots of, you know, valuable household goods, silver and china and gold and gemstones, and all of it was confiscated. They were forced to turn everything in to the banks and post offices. And in, you know, typical Nazi and, you know, the Nazi acolytes, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, in that kind of style, they were given receipts for everything they turned in, although, of course, they were then murdered, so the receipts hardly did them any good. And all of this property, this vast amount of property, was packed onto a long train full of cargo cars. And then when the Russians were invading from the east, the train took off in the direction of Berlin. So imagine the war's coming to an end, their armies going this way and that, their millions and millions of refugees running in all directions, and there's this train worth, in today's currency, somewhere up to a $4 billion. This treasure train just chugging along the tracks all through Middle Europe until finally the war's over, the Allies have won, and the Hungarians realize that to be found in possession of the plundered wealth of a murdered people is not going to go down very well for them. So they turn it over to the U.S. military and say to the U.S. military, this is now your problem. And then the U.S. military has to decide what to do with it.
And in the course of, I think, that occupation and control of that train, a lot of things disappeared.
Absolutely.
We do know that for a fact.
We do know that. So the first thing that happened was the Hungarians started pilfering things. And one of the most remarkable stories, the head of the bureaucratic office they called the Jewish Property Office, which they could have just called the Stealing of Jewish Property Office, this guy named Arpad Toldi, he skimmed off the most valuable stuff, the currency, the gemstones, and he started hiding it all around Austria. Some of it was found. It was in the area that was occupied by the French army. And all of these Austrian milkmaids, essentially, you know, they started showing up draped in pearls and golden tiaras, and it could occur to the French that this was maybe not logically, you know, they weren't usually milking their cows with diamond, you know, earrings on. So the French confiscated what they could find. Toldi disappeared with much of it. And then, you know, stuff was looted in various ways. But then the real thing, what really started happening was that the American military, which was occupying Austria and Germany, this was the time of the Marshall Plan, these true, authentic heroes, the ones who had liberated the concentration camps, who had led the armies through those terrible battles to defeat the Germans, they were sitting in these houses that they had been billeted in Austrian homes, and the Austrians had stripped their homes bare before they turned them over to the Americans. And so they had no chairs to sit on, they had no dishes to eat from, and down the road were the contents of this train stored in a warehouse while the American military tried to figure out what to do with them. And the American generals began requisitioning items from the warehouse where the contents of the train were stored, requisitioning dishes, silver, crystal, furniture, carpets, and bit by bit by bit, the contents of the train began to evaporate. And then eventually, many, though not all of those generals, when they were sent, you know, rotated back home to the States, they just packed up what was in their house and brought it home with them.
And somewhere I read that the remaining contents were eventually auctioned off, and I think you mentioned, what, $4 billion of merchandise?
Yeah, so the estimates range up to $4 billion, so we're talking about, you know, corrected for inflation, up to $4 billion, when there was eventually an auction in 1948. And, you know, a lot of the stuff just rotted away. You know, a mink coat in a train just molders to dust. So eventually, and there were lots of mink coats, eventually when all of the stuff was auctioned in New York City in 1948, the sum total of the receipts were $150,850.
And this train became somewhat of a political pawn as well.
Absolutely.
Because Hungary was moving into the Eastern Bloc. It was occupied by the Soviet Union at that time. The feeling among American authorities is that items would never return to the heirs of the original owners. Anyway, it would be confiscated by the government. So it was a bit of a political no man's land.
Right. The Americans, I mean, you have to see this from the Americans' point of view as well. The Hungarian, some of the Jews of Budapest, about half of them survived. In Hungarian countryside, 90% of the Jews were murdered. But in Budapest, about half of the Jews survived, and they started saying, hey, give us our stuff. We have receipts. Give us our stuff. But on the other hand, when the French government did turn over what they found, you know, what they confiscated from those milkmaids, what happened? The Soviet government in Hungary, the invading Soviet government, said, oh, who knows who this stuff belonged to, and just kept it. So by now, as soon as the war was over, it became very clear that the real enemy of the American government was Russia. And America was very busy trying to turn Germany into an ally against Russia. And they knew that if they turned over all this property, they would simply be handing billions of dollars of property over to the Soviet government with no guarantee that the Jews would receive their belongings. And in fact, fairly strong evidence that they never would. And at the same time, there are 850,000 Holocaust survivors, Jewish Holocaust survivors in the DP camps, who the Americans are taking care of. And the international refugee organizations are saying, give us that stuff. It makes more sense to give it to us, and we will use it at least to benefit the Jews who have survived, because we need to take care. I mean, this is imagine, if you will, 750,000 traumatized people, physically, emotionally. They've lost their families. There are tens of thousands of orphans with no parents, and someone's got to pay to take care of them. So it was very, you know, seductive for the Americans to imagine, well, let's just take that property and sell it and use it to pay for all these people that we're paying for now.
And I think that's a big part of the book, especially in the days after World War II. The section on that section was, you know, how broken the society was. And, you know, there's a subplot where your protagonist of the novel, one of the protagonists of the novel, is helping displaced persons basically get to Palestine or the begin their journey to Palestine. And you see all the prejudice from the people from Palestine who are coming to take these displaced persons. They consider them political pawns themselves. That was a really a fascinating subtext to that particular part of the story.
So much going on. You have this the Jewish remnant, these 850,000 people devastated. And then there are Jews who are in Palestine who, on the one hand, feel tremendous guilt and responsibility and want to help them get out of Europe and come to Palestine. On the other hand, they have really ambivalent feelings about these people. You know, Jews about other Jews. They feel like, why did they survive? What did they do to survive when so many other millions were murdered? And moreover, can we really assimilate upwards of 750,000 broken people into our fledgling country? And they also feel, frankly, a sense of superiority. The Jews who lived in Palestine believed that if the Nazis had come for them, they never would have been sent to the gas chambers. They would have gone down fighting. Every man, would have, woman, and child would have picked up a weapon and fired back. Now, we all think that, right? Nobody likes to imagine that we would have shed our clothing and gone into those showers willingly without, without at least fighting back. But the real truth is, of course, many, many Jews in Europe did fight back. And also, you know, everybody wants to imagine him or herself a hero, but the truth is that most people are not. And the people who do exhibit a kind of heroism are often people who we find really problematic in real life. They're people who maybe don't have such clear impulse control and who act in ways that are otherwise complicated, you know? So, I'm always interested in writing about situations that are ambiguous, where everybody is both good and evil. I think there are very few people in the world who are simply clearly evil. I think the Nazis were simply clearly evil by and large, many, many of them, Hitler and his henchmen, and the, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who helped them. But at the same time, you look at a situation like that and you have to ask yourself, I like to think I would be the partisan fighting in the woods, but would I really have been?
Yeah, especially when a knife's at your throat or a gun is in your belly. It's
exactly.
A very different equation.
Absolutely.
Well, the name of the book is Love and Treasure. My guest today is Ayelet Waldman. She's the author of three previous novels, several essay collections, and the Mommy Track mystery series over the years. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. It's a really fascinating novel, not only about this Hungarian gold train, but also of a contemporary story in which opens with Jack Wiseman in 2013 is dying of cancer. And he is one of those officers. He helped some displaced persons back in the 40s. He was the officer basically in charge of guarding this gold train and keeping track of their contents in the warehouse. And he has come home with a beautiful small object, like many American officers. You know, I think, you know, all the Monument Men stories lend itself to the narrative that the American Army didn't loot. And what they didn't do is they didn't systematically loot. And I think that's an incredible difference from any other war that happened
Absolutely.
Before.
Absolutely. I mean, we saw in that movie, obviously, Monument Men, the Nazis were astonishing systematic looters. They stole everything. The Russians, traumatized by having their artworks devastated and ruined and burned and looted, also looted on their way in, you know, when their army was advancing. The Americans were not systematic. There was no policy of looting. But there was a very clear culture of what they called souveniring, taking souvenirs. And those souvenirs ranged from objects like you know, a Luger from a downed enemy soldier to the object that Jack slips in his pocket, a necklace that is perhaps not worth so much, but is certainly worth something to someone. And having that locket, he tasks his granddaughter late in his life with, you know, feeling shame for what he has done. He says to her, I can't do this anymore. I'm an old man and I'm dying, but you can go back to Europe and find out if there's anyone left. Did anyone survive who this locket belongs to? Return it for me. And she meets an art dealer in art stolen during the Holocaust who is coincidentally looking for a painting that features her locket. The woman in the painting is actually wearing her locket. And together they embark on what really amounts to a heist movie. It's sort of like a heist story about finding that painting and finding the locket and figuring out who stole it and how they can get it back.
Now, as you're writing this book, I think you actually allude to the sale of the famous Adele
Bauer,
yeah, Bauer painting, which sold for about $130 million at the time. And all of a sudden, you're seeing museums and institutions finally open up their own little dark secret, which is the fact that they either were donated or purchased very cheaply a lot of these plundered objects. And have steadfastly refused for generations, and now all of a sudden this door has opened where you're returning these artworks to their rightful owners. How did that play into the writing of the book? Because this was really starting to happen as you're writing the book.
As I was writing it. I mean, that story of the Adele Block Bauer painting was so fascinating to me. So here you have this family that owns that painting and others by Gustav Klimt. They are forced to sell them at a pittance, and they end up in the hands of the Austrian National Museum, where they're displayed for decades. And there's a lawsuit, and eventually the painting is returned, that painting and others are returned to the niece of Mrs. Blockbauer, of the subject of the painting, Adele Blockbauer. Now, that is a kind of justice. She is the only surviving heir. It was her aunt's painting, and she sells it to the Neue Gallery in New York, where it is again available for view. It's not like she kept it to herself in secret. And she sold it for, like you say, well over $100 million. There is a kind of justice there. But somehow it feels to me like there's also a windfall, and there's also a hollowness, because what you really want is you want for Adele Block Bauer to, for her children never to have been murdered, and for her descendants to have decided, whenever they decided to sell the painting or not sell the painting or keep it in their family. And this lawsuit and the justice that ensued is a form of justice. I'm not denying that. But it has a ring of hollowness, at least to me. And that's what one of the things that inspired this book, this idea that art endures, but the people who inspire art can be so easily murdered, and their whole culture and society can vanish into ash. I think what's most fascinating about the portrait of Adele Block Bauer is not that it's a beautiful painting, which it is, and I encourage everyone to go to the Neue Gallery in New York and see it and the other paintings of the period, but that it is a symbol of this incredible society in Europe, this society of Jewish intellectuals and artists and musicians and financiers and a whole world that vanished into nothing, into ash and into dust. And that's, to me, where the real tragedy lies.
You know, the third part of the book goes back to the creation of that object and the story behind that. That was an interesting decision to put that in the book. How did you go about arranging that, and how did that come about? Did it come about naturally? Did you say, okay, now that I've set the story, I've got to tell how this object came into being?
Absolutely. And I also wanted, I wanted the reader to know what we lost, what it was that was there in Hungary. I mean, what the lives of these people were like. And it's about this young woman who's a suffragist, and she wants to be a doctor, and she lives in 1913 in Budapest at a time when nice Jewish girls married men chosen by their fathers and didn't go to cafes unescorted by chaperones. And she was part of this, you know, awakening movement of young women. They were struggling to receive the right to vote, and they wanted to go to university, and she wants to go to medical school. And there was this incredible richness to this culture and excitement and vibrancy. And that's what I wanted that section of the book to show that it's not just a painting that's vanished. It's a whole world. And people who cared about their lives and their loves as much as we care about our lives and loves, and that all of this is just so terribly fragile. Just as, you know, the characters, Nina, the young woman, and her psychoanalyst, Dr. Zobel, they had no more inclination that their entire world would vanish than we have right now that our entire world could vanish. And, I ended the book with that to give you a sense both of the joy and the poignancy of that lost world.
And I know your husband and you basically read each other's work very, very carefully. I'd like to know a little bit about that. Michael Chabon and you, I think one of you said, neither of us lets anything leave the house until the other has been over with a fine-tooth comb.
We have this, you know, I'm so lucky because I didn't go to a writing program. You know, a lot of people, a lot of novelists, they go to these MFA programs. I didn't do that. I was a lawyer. You know, I got my training at Harvard Law School. They don't stress creative writing in that otherwise wonderful institution. But I feel like learning to write with Michael as my model was really my writing program. And he edits me, and I edit him with this incredible ruthlessness that you can only bring to someone that you absolutely love and who knows that you love them. I mean, I remember once I had a group of women friends who are all writers over for like a little lady writer tea. And I happened to have left a manuscript out that Michael had just edited for me. and it was covered in red. I mean, big scrawling things like, do better, DB, that's his favorite note, DB, DB, do better, do better, do better. And sections crossed out and scribbled over, and they were horrified because most people today, you know, that you don't get that kind of, both that kind of attention and that kind of clear-eyed cruelty, and I mean that in the best possible sense of the word, from anybody else. Yes, honesty. And I do the same thing for him. You know, I don't write DB, I write yuck. So when he gets back a manuscript for me, it's like covered in the word yuck. But also, we are each other's greatest fans, and we are so intense and intensely critical because, you know, I believe that there is no writer in the English language who is as brilliant and magically gifted as my husband. And I think I'm entitled to say that because I married him, but I'm also a good judge of fiction. And, you know, he loves my work, too, and we love each other. And this is, you know, it's a great, I don't want to sound cloying and gooey, but it's a real expression of how much we care about each other, how attentive we are to one another's work. You know, it's like a family business. Sometimes we'll be puzzling over a problem in one of our novels, and we'll go for a long walk, and then we'll come home, and we'll talk about it as we make dinner, and we're still talking about it at the dinner table, and the kids will start participating and piping in, and sometimes they have great ideas. Sometimes they have crazy ideas. Sometimes maybe the thoughts of an 11-year-old who is obsessed with dystopian fantasy and video games is not necessarily what you're needing, but sometimes the thoughts of an 11-year-old who's obsessed with dystopian novels and video games is actually just the perfect idea for, you know, to get you out of your plot hole. So, you know, there's some families that, you know, they run general stores together, and we, in our family business, is fiction writing.
Wow, that's really great. Well, I think it would be very difficult. What you've really managed to bridge is that bridge between your love and care for each other and your professional passions, because I think a lot of times those lines get blurred when it's you're talking about family and family relationships. It's almost like you're too close to be able to have that honesty and collaboration rather than domination and conflict. I think,
you know, it's really funny. There was one situation, you know, sometimes you get blinded by that. You're right. You know, I edited his book, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, very, very closely, and that book went through two completely different iterations. And I was just, you know, I had my pen out, he had my pen out. We were both, the number of words that ended up on the cutting room floor would give you, would chill you to your bone. I mean, like, complete versions of that novel were thrown out. And what ended up, I think, is just really fabulous. But it wasn't until he handed it into his editor that she said something about the main female character being me. And in all the years that I had been reading and giving notes on that book, I had never noticed that and she is exactly me. Hmm. Like, exactly. And I had never noticed. Maybe because I'm blind to my own flaws. I don't know what it was. Or maybe I was so invested in the book as a book and what he was trying to do. But it was just so hilarious that it took this person saying, you know, Bina is basically you, I yell it. And I was just like, what? Oh, my God, you're right.
Well, that could be a horrible moment of clarity.
Yes, it is, right? It is. You know, and I've almost been, by then I had read it probably 20 times, and I wasn't up to reading it again. But at some point, I'm going to go back and read it and just reassure myself.
Well, the name of the new novel is Love and Treasure. Again, it has three stories in the book of Captain Jack Wiseman, who is guarding the Hungarian gold train. The contemporary story of him tasking his granddaughter to return a locket that he stole from the gold train years ago. And then, of course, the story of the locket itself, which was set in 1913, Budapest Jewish Society. And it's a really, really well put together book, I have to tell you. What's been the reaction so far? Because, you know, some of the things we've talked about during this conversation, the idea of Holocaust survivors as broken people, you know, that's maybe not set well with people. And I know that sometimes when you write things, people really react strongly to them. The whole doll mommy thing from a few years ago.
Yes, yes. You know, the reaction has been incredible. I have a policy that I don't read reviews because for someone who is so willing to say things that are so controversial, I seem to have a peculiarly thin skin. I only ever remember negative things, even in an incredibly positive review, the only thing that I'll remember is the sort of the one ambivalent comment. But I actually have had to read the reviews of this because Michael just keeps saying, you must look at this. These reviews have been so wonderful. They have been phenomenal. There was one Jewish press that was a little worried about how I was portraying the Israelis. But, you know, the best example of all this is when the book first went out to the foreign publishers to sell in different countries, my Israeli publisher was a little nervous about that, maybe it seemed like I was saying something that was a little bit anti-Israel, which, you know, I vociferously disagreed, and they eventually agreed with me. But on the same day that they expressed those concerns, a British publisher who did not end up taking the book — I have a phenomenal British publisher — but this one who didn't take the book said they were rejecting the book because it was too Zionist. So on the one day, in one day, I heard both the words "too Zionist" and the phrase "not Zionist enough." So I feel like if you do that, if you're criticized from both ends, then the chances are you're hitting that sweet spot.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's very well researched, the history of the gold train as well as Budapest society in the pre-World War I days, which was, again, as you mentioned, a very vibrant society. And it must have been fun to go and do that research.
Oh, it was great. You know, I had this wonderful coincidence, which was that one of my very closest friends, Eleni Tsikopoulos Kounalakis, was appointed ambassador to Hungary, which is one of the reasons that I chose to set the book in that society. So I highly recommend to fiction writers, if one is going to a foreign country to do research, to have as one's best friend the American ambassador, because doors open like you wouldn't believe. You know, you say, gosh, I wish I could meet this man. And she says, oh, so funny, I just met him at a party. And then suddenly the museum is open for you, and you go in and you meet, you know, the director. And she never used her influence in any way, but just the very fact of being there, you know, as her guest made things so much simpler for me. The research part is the best part. The research part is so much fun. You find these photo archives. You could spend days sifting through these old photographs and, you know, even microfilm, which, gave me a migraine, the likes of which I can't even describe. But even so, you're looking at these phenomenal old newspapers from the time. The research is the best part. The research you could do forever. In fact, the research is so fun that you have to force yourself to stop at some point and actually write. Because it's, you know, the writers, there are occasional days of writing that are really great, but many, many days of writing are just toil and slog and misery and self-doubt. But research is just always fun. So you find yourself deferring those days of toil and slog in favor of the days that are super fun and exciting and research, and you could do that for a decade and end up with no book. So after a number of months of travel and research, I forced myself to sit down and just write.
Love and Treasure is the name of the new novel. Ayelet, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure, Rich.
Ayelet Waldman's latest novel is titled Love and Treasure. It's published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.